With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Telling it as it is, David Curtin on TNT.
Hello, you're watching The David Curtin Show here on today's News Talk TNT, where we give you the unvarnished truth about what's going on in the world. Now, it's Friday today, and I would like to talk today and have a little bit of a review of the political situation in the UK. Yesterday, there was a poll. Now, that's nothing unusual because in an election year, there are many, many polls. They're coming out every month, sometimes every week. But this was interesting for a couple of reasons. Now, it still put Labour way ahead of the fake Conservative Party. Labour on 44%, the fake Conservatives on 23%. But the gap has narrowed slightly from a week or a month before. So Labour were down 1 percentage point, the fake Conservatives up 1. Also, Reform, who are being touted everywhere as the main challenger party, were also down 1%. So the narrative over this year has been they're going up and up and up in the polls, but this time it seems that they're coming down. Now, I don't particularly trust polls that are coming out. I mean, YouGov, for instance, is actually owned and run by a Tory ex-minister. I think Nadeem Zahawi, who used to be the vaccines minister. So a lot of the time, the polls that come out are not actually representative of what people actually think and are actually going to do, but they're half propaganda tools to get you to believe that the trend is going in a certain direction. So it's as much propaganda as assessing the statistics of what people are thinking. But this is interesting for a couple of reasons. Now, if you put in also the Lib Dems on 10% and the Greens on 5%, it's very disappointing to me to see that if you add up Tory, Labour, Lib Dem, Green, they add up to 83% on this poll. So this means that 83% of people, according to this, are still supporting the Uniparty. And there is no difference anymore between fake Conservative, Labour, Lib Dem and Green. They are all pushing the climate net zero alarmist narrative. Even if there is some fake difference, Labour are going to implement it by 2030, the fake Conservatives by 2035, there's no real difference in where we're going to end up. They are all woke to some degree or another. Relationships and sex education has been put into schools by the Tories in England, Labour in Wales, the SNP in Scotland, as I've said before. They are all escalating war in Ukraine. They all want more weapons sales to Israel, never mind the genocide that is going on in Gaza. So on everything that has happened over the last 4 years, including them all being for lockdown and all being for injections, experimental injections, and no jab, no job, they've been on the wrong side of everything, as has the challenger party, which is touted as the opposition, which is Reform UK. They were for stricter border controls, travel restrictions at the start of the lockdown. Richard Tice, as we know, there's video evidence that he called for no jab, no job in something which was called Tice Talk in 2021 when he was having a discussion about it with his deputy leader, David Bull. They are for more weapons and money to the Ukraine and the Zelensky regime. I debated that, if you can call it a debate, in September 2022 on another channel with Piers Morgan and Richard Tice, who were opposing me as I called for de-escalation in the Ukraine. And what they are doing at the moment is smearing the pro-ceasefire rallies using the cultural Marxist language of them being hate rallies, just like Suella Braverman is doing, which is paving the way for more restrictions on freedom of speech and more restrictions on legitimate peaceful protests by people who are seriously concerned about the deaths of tens of thousands of people, mostly women and children, in Gaza by the state that calls itself Israel. I wonder if this is peak Reform UK, because they are having lots and lots of negative press at the moment because they're deselecting candidates at the behest of the far left, hope not hate. The candidates they had in Orpington and South Ribble were specifically mentioned by Hope Not Hate as people who had put out posts on social media that they didn't approve of, and straight afterwards, Reform UK deselected them as candidates. I actually personally know the former candidate for Orpington, Mick Greenhow. He was around, very much an activist for Brexit, for leaving the EU, for the referendum, back in the referendum, pre-referendum days. Latterly, just yesterday, we hear that they deselected the candidate for York Central called Tommy Corkwell on the basis that he wasn't responding to emails and communications. Then it turned out that he's actually been dead for 2 months. Now, that's a very sad situation. Obviously, someone has died. His family would be grieving, but for Reform UK to deselect a candidate, not knowing that he'd actually died, really says quite a lot about them. I've never heard of any such story in 10 or more years of being involved in politics. Now, I'm biased, of course, and I think a lot of people are very much questioning how they are being swayed and they are obedient to this far-left organization, Hope Not Hate, at the moment, for what they're saying about their candidates. And this is a party that says it believes in free speech, but doesn't seem to let that many people have free speech. David Carpin was another candidate for Henley. And he just put up a couple of posts that I don't see much wrong with. There was one that said pride is a sin, and it was a polemic against the LGBTQIPP Pride Month in June, and it had a picture of someone with a broom sweeping a gay pride rainbow into the drain, which I think is absolutely the right message, because pride is a sin, according to Christian orthodoxy, and we certainly don't want people and children being drawn into these degenerate events which go on in June. Now, he also put up a meme with the EU flag with the 12 stars turned into 12 swastikas. Now, I wouldn't advise that, but you could argue, well, the EU is actually giving real, genuine support to the Zelensky regime in Ukraine, which is infested, as we know, with real neo-Nazis like the Azov Battalion that wear swastikas in the pictures of them when they do promotion for themselves. And for 8 years, from 2014 to 2022, the mainstream media in this country said Ukraine has a Nazi problem. We have the EU and we have EU countries supporting a regime with real Nazis in it and influencing it and around it. Now, I wouldn't put that meme out myself, but it does make a point, and it's something that generates thought and discussion. I wouldn't have fired him as a candidate. I would welcome him as a candidate, but Reform UK have different opinions. Of course, as I said, I'm biased. I'm the leader of the Heritage Party. I do believe in freedom of speech. I do believe we should be de-escalating foreign conflicts around the world. I do believe that we should not have locked down at all. We shouldn't have had any restrictions on travel, let alone masks or anything like that, or social distancing. And I certainly would not have rolled out any experimental injection at all, which hadn't undergone 10 years years of rigorous safety testing so that we don't get the adverse health effects that we're seeing now all over the place. So if you are disillusioned with the Uniparty and the fake opposition to the Uniparty, please do come and join me in the Heritage Party. We are going to try and make a real change for this country. I know I'm biased, but there we go. Sometimes I can say that here. This is today's News Talk, TNT.
Bringing you a world view.
I like to hear what's going on around the world.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to today's News Talk, TNT. I spoke for a long time then. Gemma, you're here. I'm sorry, I've eaten into your time. I know you're dying to tell us the latest news headlines in the UK. So please go ahead. Tell us what's going on.
Well, it doesn't matter, David. It's Friday. You know, we'll all give each other a degree of largesse on a Friday, won't we? And you make some very good points. It is a uni party. And this headline that I'm about to bring, which I've discussed already this morning, but it's worth further analysis. Labour today are pledging to spend 2.5% of GDP on defence if they win the next election. That's matching the Conservative pledge to 2.5 GDP. There we go. It's a uniparty pledge, isn't it? Both of them trying to appease Donald Trump. I have no doubt about that, saying they're both committed to NATO. Sir Keir Starmer is visiting a nuclear submarine base in Barrow-in-Furness in Cumbria today, where he's expected to make these announcements. But yeah, it's a uniparty. Both of them pledging 2.5% on GDP on defence, saying it's the top number one election issue. I think that's news to the electorate, actually, who probably think immigration and the NHS are the number one joint issues they'd like political parties to focus on. But there we go. Like you say, uniparty. Talking of uniparties, Boris Johnson, he's thrown his hat back into the ring and says he hasn't ruled out a return to frontline politics. Speaking at a university in America, he said he would come back if he thought he had something to contribute. Interesting that. And also UK farmers, if it couldn't get any worse for our poor UK farmers who've already been demonstrating in Westminster over the last few weeks, this big tractor protest that we saw only a few weeks ago, a record-breaking rain over the last few months has led to UK farmers' crops being underwater and the lives of their livestock at risk. They are calling on the government, the biggest farming union in the country, the NFU, is calling on the government to do more to support domestic food production. This, of course, comes on top of the protests that the farmers have done here in the UK on EU red tape and regulations and cheap imports, which they say are preventing them from making a living. So they're just a few of the headlines, top headlines doing the rounds here in the UK on TNT this hour.
Thanks, Gemma. Well, you know, they're all very interesting stories. I mean, you know, with Boris, I don't think he's going to come back because he's not an MP anymore. And I don't think anyone would want him back. He's in their right mind. But, you know, the defence story, I mean, that was interesting. You know, both the Tories, the fake Conservatives and Labour pledging 2.5% of GDP for defence. Now, look, I'm not averse to spending more money on defence, but it depends where it goes. I mean, you can spend more on defence. But at the moment, what is happening, you know, we still spend quite a lot on defence in this country anyway. I think it's 2% at the moment. But the number of armed servicemen has been declining, is going down and down and down over the years. And you do question, well, what is the money going on when they do spend it on defence? I mean, it seems a lot of it is not going to build up the armed forces in this country. We're buying weapons and we're sending it off to Ukraine, like a lot of other countries in Western Europe are doing. And that is not doing anything to defend our own country. I wouldn't mind them increasing the defence budget if the Royal Navy were actually defending our southern border in the English Channel and pushing these migrant boats coming across back to France, which is what they should be doing, rather than escorting them to the UK. And we don't know anything about these mostly military-age men. We have apparently 40,000 people on the terror watch list, and many of them are people who've come across in these dinghies that we don't know anything about. So, you know, there's no point in spending any more money on defence when it's not actually going into defending our nation. It's actually going into making our nation less safe and then attacking other countries and escalating wars in other parts of the world. That's not defence. That's making our security situation worse.
Well, absolutely. And I think of some very telling comments from Keir Starmer about this 2.5%. He said he was absolutely committed to NATO and fulfilling their commitment to NATO. And of course, what did Donald Trump say a few weeks ago? If you're not paying your way in NATO and you're a NATO member, we're not going to support you as America with our military industrial complex if you get into trouble. So I think this is all about appeasing Trump, who they know is going to win the next US election without a doubt. And that both political parties in the UK doing everything they can now to whip up the defence rhetoric, which until a few weeks ago from both parties was silent. I mean, our UK budget, our Chancellor Jeremy Hunt, he didn't give any money to the defence budget in the budget. And that's one of the reasons why our Armed Forces Minister James Heapy is said to have resigned and quit not just his post as Defence Minister, but UK politics as a whole. He's standing down as an MP at the next election, another Conservative MP going. And suddenly, defence is on the agenda. Oh, we're going to spend loads of money, 2.5%. Absolutely, no question about it. Both the Tories and Labour saying that. So, you know, nothing by accident in politics. And like you say, it doesn't go where it should be going. It goes on Ukraine. And funnily enough, former defence minister today, James Heapy, now he's not in post anymore. He's officially quit and he can speak a bit more freely. He has said the UK government should absolutely consider sending UK troops to the front line. So it's not just weapons they're considering, you know, spending this money on. It's whatever beleaguered UK troops are around, ship them off to Ukraine and let them do their bit. This comes just a week after dodgy Dave Cameron, our unelected foreign secretary, said, no, we'll never send troops to Ukraine. Well, as soon as he said that, I thought, oh, that means the opposite. We'll be going soon enough. And it's interesting, just on that note, we'll wrap up this segment, but you say that Boris Johnson couldn't come back because he's not an MP anymore. Well, lo and behold, dodgy Dave Cameron came back. He wasn't an MP. Just make them a Lord. Bring them back into the cabinet. Mm. There we go. Job done. So stranger things have happened on that one. I think Boris Johnson will be back personally, and I'd be very interested to see the reaction that garners.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think he's just gone away for a time and he's going to try to come back somehow. His scheming or whatever role he is there to play is not over yet. But, you know, I'm doing my best to kick out these people. And but I can only do it with the help of many, many other people who are supporters. So, you know, I do thank everybody for watching the show, for getting informed, for listening to the truth, for speaking the truth, and for people who are actively getting involved in politics and standing as candidates and supporting our candidates. I do say thank you very much. And I say thank you as well to you, Gemma, for bringing those stories to us today. Good to see you. This is today's News Talk, TNT.
TNT's Mark Morano.
Only 54% of the residents of Ethiopia have access to electricity.
Wah, wah, wah.
Ethiopia's leaders are making the country go all electric vehicle when nearly half of the population doesn't have access to electricity. That's commitment. My mind is blown. Do you understand what I'm saying? A country which one of the among the poorest in the world is banning gas-powered cars, EV only, no imports. They're doing their part to fight, quote, planet warming pollution, unquote. And almost half the population doesn't even have access to electricity.
Mark Morano on today's News Talk, TNT. TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission. If you're still wearing a cloth or surgical mask around in public, you're guilty of spreading COVID misinformation. It really is that simple. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the David Curtin Show here on today's News Talk, TNT. Now, it's really good to have with me Dan Astin Gregory, who is an entrepreneur, a strategist, and the founder of lots of different projects. We're going to talk about some of the things you're doing at the moment, but Dan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, David. It's great to be here with you this morning.
No, great to see you. Great to have you on the show. Now, at the moment, you're involved in a couple of things that you're just doing at the moment. So you're wearing a T-shirt, I think, that says Free Humanity. And along with that, there's something that you're doing as well, which is the Road to Geneva convoy, which is happening later this year. Can you tell us about those projects and what you're doing with them?
Yeah, so Free Humanity is something that I've been developing really since the beginning of the response to COVID. I was heavily involved in the activist movement in the UK to challenge the lockdown restrictions and mandates and related issues around the COVID injections. Launched a podcast, which we did over 1,000 episodes, reached over 15 million people, really just spreading information about, like you have here on this channel, about some of the things that are really posing challenges to the society. But it's been a transformational period for me because I now see that it's not just COVID. There are many other implications for our long-term freedoms and liberties and rights, and particularly in the developed world. In fact, you know, when people talk about liberties and rights, they often talk about, you know, countries that are under dictates by authoritarian leaders. Well, you could argue that we now have that at a global scale in the developed world. So we launched Free Humanity in January to really create a global grassroots freedom movement to advance and defend our freedoms around the world. And we made the commitment from the Greater Reset in Mexico, which Derek Brose hosts, that our first campaign would be to tackle the WHO pandemic treaty, or the pandemic agreement, as it's now called, and the International Health Regulation Amendment. So the Road to Geneva is our very first campaign, straight out of the blocks. And yeah, I'm really excited to share that. This is a media first. You know, this is the first announcement we're making about this, but we're creating a pan-European convoy, you know, inspired by the Canadian truckers. So imagine thousands of people. It's a citizens convoy this time, you know, so don't, you know, we don't have the same trucker culture in Europe as they have in Canada and America. So, you know, we're inviting everyone across Europe to come and join us to take a stand in Geneva. We're leaving on the 30th of May. We're going to assemble on the 1st of June outside the UN and the WHO headquarters to make our message clear. And I'm happy to share more about the background to the campaign and what we hope to achieve. But that's us getting out of the gate with a brand new project and a brand new campaign to launch Free Humanity.
Fantastic. So, I mean, this is because obviously the WHO is having the World Health Assembly in Geneva in May later this year. And that is when there's going to be a big vote on, you know, this pandemic treaty, or, you know, as you say, pandemic agreement. I think it's not so much a treaty, but the effect of this is going to be, I think it's they're going to change the International Health Regulations 2005 to bring in all kinds of tyrannical rules, and they're going to facilitate themselves to be able to impose rules on their member states. What is your understanding of this pandemic agreement that is going to be made if it gets voted through later this year?
Well, obviously, it stemmed from off the back of the response to COVID, and there's this kind of jump to move into pandemic preparedness to prepare for the next thing that happens. Mm-hmm. And as a result, what this potentially risks is normalizing a lot of the things that happened during COVID, which, you know, many of us are quite clear during the event, let alone after the event, where there is now increasing evidence that confirmed that, you know, the vast majority of policies that were undertaken were based on political decisions and not scientific or medical or public health evidence. But this agreement really, really potentially normalizes all of those things. And it's a slide towards ever-increasing centralization of health governance, meaning that WHO is positioning itself as the sole authority of global health. And there are many different risks within the documents. And it's not just about public health risks like a pandemic, for instance. They are now describing any potential health risk, which, if you think about it, could be anything, which is why there's concerns around the conversations around climate and other issues that could be termed a public health interest. Mm. And as a result, these mechanisms could be deployed. So the biggest threat really is to our, and they would refutely deny this, but it's a centralization of this ideology, really. So no matter what the laws or the treatments, the treaty says, it's really a continuation of the spirit in which the last 3 years and 4 years have unfolded, which is being documented and ratified and agreed upon by these nations. Well, hopefully not agreed upon by these nations. There is some dissenting voices. But it's a real risk to localized health autonomy and how each individual nation and its constituent parts make its decisions, which is obviously you know, there is no one size fits all approach. But as we saw during COVID, that's kind of what happened. And there was very few outliers. And this really risks enhancing that and bringing this greater global centralization and taking less and taking more and more power away from local states to make their own decisions. And of course, these are legally binding documents, and there is a whole range of risks, you know, within each of these documents. So it's really important that we take a stand against these, and that's why we've launched this campaign, not only to raise awareness. We call it the Road to Geneva because there's lots of action in the build up. Because you're quite right, the WHA assembly. At the latter part of May, this whole campaign is due to coincide with that. We're taking a whole range of actions to try and prevent or halt the or delay the ratification of these documents. But fundamentally, the convoy will culminate in our Declaration of Independence, essentially saying, you know, irrespective of what decisions are made, we commit to taking our own independent, autonomous path and take our health future into our own hands, because we can't be at the mercy of these global central organizations. We need to retain that localized ability to make our own healthcare decisions.
I absolutely agree. And national sovereignty is something, you know, I've been speaking about even before the whole COVID lockdown situation happened with Brexit and so on. But, you know, this is part of that. A nation should have sovereignty over its own policies and be able to decide what health policies and actions it takes in its own territory without some fabricated global government stepping in and saying, oh, no, we're the authority now, even though they're not elected by anybody or anything. So absolutely. We'll talk more about this very important subject after this quick news break. This is today's News Talk, TNT.
Here we go.
TNT Radio News.
News.
TNT, this is James O'Neill. Australian Foreign Minister Penny Wong has announced the Labour government's support for the recognition of a Palestinian state amidst ongoing conflict in Gaza. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has announced a significant policy shift regarding retail crime, declaring that assaulting shop workers will soon be recognized as a separate criminal offence. MP William Ragg has resigned from the Conservative Party after admitting to being manipulated into sharing politicians' phone numbers with someone he met on Grindr, a gay dating app.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the David Curtin Show on today's News Talk, TNT, and Dan Aston Gregory is here talking about the Road to Geneva, which is a project, a massive event that Dan is organising in the UK with, I think, other people around Europe, protesting against the World Health Organization pandemic agreement that is coming in. So, Dan, how has the response been so far, or is it in the early stages of planning for the Road to Geneva convoy?
Well, we actually literally announced it last night, so it's fresh out of the gates. And as I mentioned, this is the first show that we've spoken about this, which is fantastic. We're working with a range of coalition partners across Europe, and indeed US and Canada, Australia, New Zealand, because it's clearly a global challenge. But the convoy will take place across many nation states across Europe. We're obviously getting lots of questions around logistics already. So, you know, people can go to road2geneva.com to find out about that as we announce all those elements. But what's really interesting about the way we're coordinating this campaign, we're working in global collaboration, we're working in coalition, but we haven't formed a central body in order to do that. You know, we haven't created this one-size-fits-all approach. So many of the proponents of the pandemic treaty, for instance, say, well, we need greater collaboration. That's why we need these documents. This is why we need the WHO. And on paper, that sounds all very reasonable. But people aren't considering that there is an alternative. You don't need to have one global authority to determine how to globally collaborate. Nations have collaborated in the particularly the digital world, where communication across borders is far easier than ever before. There are many alternatives. So part of the reason why we're doing this is to say, look, we understand some of the needs that people are citing. They're very real needs. But to position the World Health Authority organization as the only way to do that is flawed. So what we're not only are we challenging and resisting what's happening, we're really hoping to position a range of alternatives, but also to call for an independent inquiry into the WHO's handling of the pandemic response. Because quite frankly, you know, if you are going to sign documents and treaties and amendments to international health regulations that have wide sweeping implications, then surely we're putting the cart before the horse here. Because what's important to say is, well, let's take a look first at how the WHO operated during COVID and prior to COVID, because indeed prior to COVID, there was already lots of skepticism about the changing nature of the WHO, conflicts of interest, corruption, and some of those things have played out dramatically through COVID, particularly around the pharmaceutical elements. So we really need to understand, firstly, why should we trust the WHO to actually become a coordinating body? You know, I'm under no disillusion that, you know, the WHO during its history undoubtedly has done some good work, but at the same time, it's no longer the same organization that it was when it first started. So we've really got to scrutinize its role in global health governance. And we've really also got to look at, you know, our role locally and nationally when it comes to things like public health and public health management, and understand the importance of our ability to operate independently. Because interestingly enough, I used to work in financial services, and we worked on this project called One Best Way. And as a result of doing that project, the conclusion was there is no one best way, and that it's best that we have some similarities and some common values, but ultimately we need to operate independently because there are so many nuances and conditions that make our own territories and cultures and countries different. So, and the same is going to apply here. So we really need to think carefully about what we entertain when it comes to documents like the treaty and the amendments.
I totally agree with you. I mean, that's a really, really good point, is that, you know, it's good to talk to each other and how people do different things that have grown up in different cultures and different societies around the world and look for best practice. And you can find examples of really good things that people are doing in Russia or America or India, Brazil, UK, wherever. But you don't need to impose exactly the same systems on a sort of big technocratic basis all around the world, to then which no one would be able to divert from or defer from if it suited their nations better. And the other big concern I have, you know, which you sort of alluded to there, is how the World Health Organization has changed. And now it seems to be completely beholden and captured by big pharmaceutical interests and then these big NGOs and foundations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation that are very, very supportive and want a program to roll out vaccines and injections around the world. Indeed, would make a lot of profit from them, and Gavi and so on. So I wouldn't want a global organization that is captured by those massive corporations and global NGOs to be telling my country what to do, you know, and would almost label any difference in opinion as medical misinformation, which is a new kind of phrase that has grown up over the COVID lockdown period. You know, if you say, oh, hydroxychloroquine helps, or ivermectin helps, or vitamin D helps, then they say, no, that's medical misinformation. Don't listen to them. They're conspiracy theorists. So I don't want them telling me what I can do or I can't do. I mean, how do you see that?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that point. Frankly, on the WHO's website, they proudly state that they censored over 800,000 YouTube videos during the course of 2020-21 in a battle to tackle, yes, that autocratic term, misinformation. And of course, how many of those videos were about early treatments or prophylactics or valid questions about the pharmaceutical and non-pharmaceutical approaches? And this is the real risk that people need to understand in terms of the centralization of power, because when you have this Ministry of Truth or the Ministry of Health Truth, there is no dissenting bodies. And the point you made about looking to best practice, well, we could have all looked to Sweden for best practice. It, by all intents and purposes, almost every measure, whether it's health, GDP, happiness, any scale you look at is almost positively reinforced by Sweden's approach, yet that became the outlier. So we need to be able to look to different approaches to gain best practice, but they don't need to necessarily be adopted. If you look at the lockdowns and the lockstep approach, there was no escaping that. And that is when all of your information ecosystem then supports that narrative, then it's very difficult to escape that. So we've got a body that's trying to dictate its authority over health matters and the way in which things are done. And it's also censoring and seeking to censor platforms from actually exploring any dissenting dissenting voices or exploring any alternatives. And that's a real risk. That's one of the fundamental risks of centralization. And the weird thing is, David, is that prior to COVID, there was largely a growing body of big pharma skepticism. But it feels like big pharma skepticism died with COVID-19 because those of us who have challenged these restrictions and authorities and the practices around the COVID vaccine rollout have clearly got renewed skepticism in big pharma. But many of those that prior to COVID were skeptical have seemingly now aligned with it. And you look at the treaty and the amendments, and it's almost like they've been written by big pharma lawyers. And you're right, the funding sources now, over 30% of the World Health Organization's activities is now directed towards vaccines and big pharma-related activities. And that's a huge chunk of their work. So what happens about actually developing health naturally and actually helping people to live more vibrant, healthy lives? Where's the allocation of funds for this?
Absolutely. You know, I was almost, you know, in a way, completely supportive of big pharma and vaccines and so on before this. I never questioned it. I mean, I was a chemistry teacher. I have a chemistry degree, and they just teach you, oh yeah, big pharma's doing good things. They're helping with diseases. Vaccines are good. They help you to protect your body from diseases. But I've seen the way that people have been totally squashed and smeared just for questioning things, which you know, and asking good scientific questions about this, and have been ostracized and cancelled, including myself, because I'm just asking questions. And it seems you can't even ask questions these days about what is coming from as the narrative from the World Health Organization and other things. Anyway, look, Dan, we're out of time today, but this is a really great project. Just finally, tell people where they can find out more about this if they want to find out information about it.
Yeah, simply go to roadtogeneva.com. That's where you find out all the information about the convoy. You can register interest to join us, and we'll be sending you more information over the weeks ahead. Everything you need to know to join us on the convoy.
That's great. Dan, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. This is today's News Talk, TNT.
From weather and traffic reports
to news of political developments,
we turn to journalists for the information we need to live our daily lives.
Journalists around the world provide the news that is essential for democracy,
for personal freedom, and for safety and stability.
Yet their ability to report freely and safely is under attack like never before.
So many journalists are paying with their lives.
They face exponential risks, and they've already paid a heavy toll.
Death threats, online harassment, and physical attacks
are becoming a daily experience of journalists in all countries.
Absolutely.
We just want people to be safe, to be able to get our readers the information that they need to make informed decisions.
They checked my phone and realized that it was Pegasus. I feel myself like I'm naked in the street.
These charges were politicized from the start.
Facts win. Truth wins. Justice wins.
C'est énorme pour moi d'être là, d'être libre, ce que je ne m'attendais pas du tout.
Stand with a free press.
Stand with journalists whose reporting won't be silenced. Press freedom is your freedom.
Hi, I'm Smokey Bear, and I made an assistant to help you out, because only you can prevent wildfires.
Hey, Assistant Smokey Bear, call me Papa Bear, because I'm grilling up dinner. Do you get it?
Yes, good job.
So, what should I do with all these coals?
Don't just toss them out. Put them in a metal container, because those embers can start a wildfire.
I understand. The stakes are high.
Ha 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 ha.
See, Smokey thinks I'm funny.
You're with David Curtin on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the David Curtin Show on today's News Talk, TNT. Now, it's really great to have with me Raqib Ehsan, who is a commentator on many, many media outlets. I think you've been on, written for The Mail, The Sun, The Spectator, Spiked. You've been on GB News, Talk TV, the BBC, so many shows. So obviously you have a lot of very important things to say. And you were the author of Beyond Grievance, What the Left left gets wrong about ethnic minorities. Now, just to begin with, can you tell us a little bit about that book and, you know, some of the things that you wrote in that book and explain some of the things that the narratives that we get from the left, which the mainstream media is controlled by, and what they're saying?
No, sure. Firstly, David, thank you for having me. Really appreciate the invitation. Yeah. I think in terms of the book, one of the main motivating factors behind writing Beyond Grievance, What the Left Gets Wrong About Ethnic Minorities, is I felt that many of the liberal left narratives surrounding the life of ethnic minority families across the country was ridiculously skewed. I think it's overly doom and gloom, exceptionally negative. And I think that I needed to bring some facts to the table. And I think the reality is, and you'll know this better than anyone, David, is that there's many ethnic minority families, they're incredibly proud of their British identity. And many originate from parts of the world where there's rampant political corruption, significant social unrest. Indeed, they're fleeing civil war and originating from conflict-affected territories. So when they come to the UK, many of those families have naturally positive orientations towards British democracy, which is comparatively very stable, provides their family, provides their children with ample educational and economic opportunities to thrive. So I think what I wanted to achieve with the book is to say, actually, Britain ranks quite well when it comes to providing ethnic and racial minorities with the opportunities to start afresh. And when it comes to children who are born and raised in the UK, they still have some of the most greatest opportunities to really maximise their potential.
Well, I mean, that is a fantastic message to get out, and is the truth, and I know it. And you know that what disturbs me about what you often get from the mainstream media, which I would say is almost completely captured by the left or by the Fabians or cultural Marxists, whatever you like to call them, is they're continually pushing a victim narrative that everyone who's an ethnic minority is a victim, and it simply isn't true.
No, it's not. It's not true at all. And I think that many ethnic minority people in the UK would find it deeply patronising and condescending. They don't enjoy being subjected to that kind of what I call hyper paternalism. They don't need protection from what I often consider to be, in my view, a fairly mediocre white British liberals with a white saviour complex. They don't have any time for that whatsoever. And if you see, David, you'll know this, especially when it comes to education and economic outcomes. Ethnic minorities, for example, originating from India, China, Nigeria, some of the highest performing in the country now, in some ways, if truth be told, they're significantly outperforming their white British peers in the mainstream. That's why I really take issue with these white privilege theories, which essentially racialize disadvantage. I actually think the greatest disadvantage you can have living in the UK, if you don't belong to a stable family unit, if you don't have two parents at home, and if you don't belong to a community where there's intergenerational connection, where young people can really draw on the knowledge and wisdom of their elders in their local neighborhood.
That's absolutely right. I mean, I've been saying that the same thing for a long time. Is that, you know, you look at London and there's a huge amount of crime and there's a huge amount of gang crime. And tragically, the people that seem to get into it are more susceptible to this are black male teenagers. But then you look at family breakdown, it's much, much higher among the black community in London than it is among the white community. And it's higher among white people than it is among Indian, Pakistani, Bangladeshi people. And I actually brought that to the mayor as a question, and he just ridiculed that. You know, like he didn't even accept it, but would just like just made some snide comment. But you're actually affirming that, and that's great.
Well, you know, listen, David, you'll also know better than most of the mayor of London. He doesn't struggle to make a fool of himself in the public domain. Now, it's very clear to me that, and this is very, this is uncomfortable territory. Yeah, we have to be honest about this. And I don't bring these facts to the table in order to offend and hurt particular communities. It's because I want to get to the root causes of these problems. And this is not about stigmatizing single parents at all, but the reality is that there's positive youth outcomes which are more strongly related to two-parent households, whether that's level of school attainment, then further down the line, level of labour market integration, and more generally, David, general life satisfaction. And I just have this statistic here. When it comes to England and Wales, 6% of Indian origin children up to the age of 16 live in a lone parent household. 6%. For their Black Caribbean or heritage peers, it goes up to 63%. Wow. 63%. That's nearly two in three children within that particular ethnic category. And if that's not going to have an impact on future educational and economic outcomes, then I don't know what will. That's a very important factor when we're analysing these kind of dynamics. And I think that more generally, when we're talking about the issue of knife crime, especially in London, there's no doubt that if you don't belong to a stable and loving family home, if you don't have a strong, responsible male role model in the household to keep in the straight and narrow, you'll look for those forms of belonging elsewhere. And unfortunately, I do think that many of the gangs that operate in London, they know who full well which young people are the most vulnerable, which are there for the taking in order to do their dirty work. But the problem is, when you become trapped in that life of gang membership, increases the likelihood of being involved in criminal activity, including knife-related crime. And we need to have these discussions. They need to be laid out in the table. I'm sorry, but we can talk about cuts. We can talk about youth centres and all the rest of it. We need to get to back to the basics and understand the value of family culture and stability in terms of shaping life chances for young people in this country, David.
I totally agree with the, it's something that we must talk about. I mean, obviously I do, as leader of the Heritage Party, we got very strong family policies, but it seems that some political parties, the uni party, as I call them, they just don't want to talk about it because they're scared of being called racist, or they're scared of being called homophobic or misogynist or something, whatever smear you throw at people. I mean, they ignore the facts.
They do. And I think it's a desperation to appear inclusive. Now, I think for me, we need to be honest about, you know, there are certain family structures which are more positively associated with the outcomes that we want to see for young people. I think this argument that, you know, a variety of families of all shapes and sizes and structures, they can work very well. But it's about patterns of association. I'm surprised that I still have to explain this to the people that I talk to, especially my good friends on the liberal left. But certain things work better. And I think those organic forms of social rootedness, that's what I call it, you know, rooted in family, community, and also more generally nation, I think that really allows people to thrive. That sense of belonging is associated with more positive mental health outcomes as well. And I think that we just need to have these conversations on the table. And I think that the political establishment has really let down the country. And I'll tell you who's let down the country the most, David. Politicians who portray themselves to be socially liberal. But if you actually look at their life history, very socially conservative, raised by mum and dad at home, which are married. Then they decided, before growing a family of their own, they decided to be married and have their children within wedlock. If it's good enough for them, why isn't it good enough for everyone else? Bigotry of low expectations. I don't like it much at all.
That is something that always puzzles me, is that some of the people that seem to be the most progressive, the most liberal, have had lovely upbringings. I mean, you see it in the same with schools. A lot of people who have been to private schools and grammar schools, indeed, and then they say, oh no, but we want to close down grammar schools because nobody should go to them, where they've had the benefit of them. And it's the same with families.
Absolutely.
I don't understand it myself, but, why would they not want the best and greater opportunities for everybody? It's bizarre.
Absolutely. It's rank hypocrisy. It shows how dangerous ideological dogma can be, that you'll suggest that this is not good enough for other people. Oh, this is absolutely fine for other people, but I would never do it myself. I think another example is drugs. If truth be told, there's politicians who support very liberal policies when it comes to drugs, drug liberalisation more generally. But if they found out that their children were taking drugs, you can be sure that they wouldn't be very happy about it at all.
Yeah, indeed. Now, obviously, immigration is a big issue in the UK at the moment, both illegal migration with asylum seekers coming across the channel, and legal migration, which has hit record levels. And we hear this week that over half the overseas development budget is being spent on housing asylum seekers who've come across the channel, which last year was I think 30,000, the year before 45,000. So they're spending 5 $1.4 billion this year, or in this fiscal year, on housing asylum seekers. I mean, what do you make of this? What should be done about this issue?
Firstly, what a fundamental policy failure that our international development budget is being drained essentially by illegal economic migration. I know that many people say that, the majority of people that are crossing the channel, they have their cases accepted and their asylum claims. That just shows me we have a very loose and overly relaxed asylum system. And I think the issue here, David, I think it's a very important point to make. I want to see an asylum system which prioritises women and children at risk of sexual violence in their homelands, the people who are very much at risk of persecution and sex-based violence. They're being left by the wayside, mainly by male-dominant illegal immigration on the English South Coast. This is a social justice issue. Forgive me for using quite progressive language, but it really is. And I think that with the international development budget, that should be used, for example, the UK in partnership with other Commonwealth member countries, which are relatively underdeveloped, to develop their economies, to move towards being more economically self-sufficient. So that budget's being drained. If truth be told. And I think that the amount of public money that's been spent in terms of rehoming illegal migrants in up to 4-star hotels in areas where there's shockingly poor standards of social housing is, again, a grave injustice. In terms of what needs to be done, and this is something that I never thought I'd say, I think that Britain needs to really reevaluate its relationship with existing international treaties and conventions, especially when it comes to human rights and refugee policy. Because I think for me, there's been far too much supranational intrusion when it comes to deciding our own matters of immigration and asylum policy. And I think from, David, you know, my background is social cohesion. I think that without a well-ordered immigration asylum regime, we won't be able to cultivate the levels of social solidarity we need, especially when it comes to supporting the sustainability of the welfare state. So I think on the left, there's some very important discussions to be had, but all too often they're being brushed aside. And I think that's going to do them not many favours at all moving into the future.
Well, you know, it's really refreshing to hear you say these things, which I think, you know, most people in the country who are affected by this and, you know, live in towns and cities where there is a big change in, you know, huge demographics and an increase in population as well. I mean, just simply in terms of mathematics, there is not the infrastructure to cope with the influx of people who are coming into the country. I mean, and people see this, and then all they get from politicians, of whether it's fake conservatives or Labour Party, left fake or right in Parliament, is like, "You're a racist. Shut up and take it. Oh, stop being racist."
Absolutely. I think the environment's become so censorious. Now, David, I'm a Bangladeshi Muslim heritage, and I'm proud of my ethnic heritage and my faith as well. I recently celebrated Eid al-Fitr. For me, though, what I really find quite depressing is how people want to express perfectly legitimate concerns. People have paid taxes all their lives, and they're right to feel at least somewhat anxious. They're trying to be honest about how they feel, anxious about the pace of demographic social change in their local communities, and asking questions about whether the local social infrastructures there are able to cope with such an influx of newcomers, including newcomers who, for example, may not have the strongest English language skills, not the highest levels of English language proficiency, and they may also originate from cultures where the prevailing social norms are very different to what we have in British liberal democracy. And I think those conversations need to be had, because if we're very serious about integrating our diverse communities, having strong amounts of social cohesion, then without having those conversations, we won't be making much headway at all.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not just illegal migration as well. I totally agree with you on that. We see the majority of people coming over on boats and on the backs of lorries are military-aged men, if you like. There's not older men. There's some children, but there's hardly any women coming across. But there's also a huge problem with legal migration. I mean, this is now out of control. You know, now 1.4 million coming into the country, you know, and it's an absolute number, 700,000 net. I mean, that is a huge challenge, you know, this is overwhelming societies as well. I mean, do you see that having as much of an effect on social integration as the illegal migration, or is there a difference there?
I think my main concern is that within your immigration system, you want to attract the brightest and the best. Unfortunately, I'm not seeing much evidence of that, if I'm being truthfully honest. Yeah. And I think it's the sheer scale. And I think the issue is that for decades, the British political establishment has sought to use immigration as a lever to pull at any opportunity to engineer for quick economic growth. Firstly, it hasn't done that. We've been a high immigration, low growth economic model. We've been attached to that for a long time. Yeah. And I think the main worry for me, David, is that we're not skilling our own people.
Yes,
that's the truth of it. We need to boost the skills in our own domestic workforce. I said that, you know, in every left behind provincial town, I'd plonk in a sort of German style vocational college there, really boost skills. Yeah. And I think we need to reverse that culture of snobbery towards certain trades. The many tradesmen across the country, they do things that I couldn't possibly do. If I tried to do it, I'd probably blow up my own house in the process, right? And I think their values really need to, their skill sets need to be deeply appreciated a lot more. And in my view, the main thing is we need to focus on national self-sufficiency. Stop trying to look for external forces to sort out your problems. And I think if we have those conversations, we'll be in a much better place.
Rakib, I totally agree with you. It sounds like you're actually reading out the Heritage Party manifesto. Self-sufficiency and skills. Absolutely what we need. Low immigration. Bring some people over. It's good to have some people. It's good to mix things up a little bit. But we need to make life work for everybody who's here.
Indeed.
And put British people first. And then the country will be better for people who arrive as well. Rakib, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Hope you can come back on the show again sometime soon. Thanks for joining me. This is Today's News Talk.
Thank you.
TNT.